Hello, my name's Mary. I'm an alcoholic. It is an honor to be here. Thank you for helping keep me sober today. I sure appreciate you guys showing up. When they asked me to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and tell my story, it occurred to me it really has to start when I was a young girl, because what occurred to me is that it is a family disease. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mom was the alcoholic, and my dad was a golfaholic. You guys know what that means, right? He played 18 holes before he went to work and 18 holes after he got off work. And, you know, he came home and expected dinner, you know. So, mom drank. And I grew up with a drinking mom and an absentee dad. I considered it absentee parents. There were four of us kids, and we were all within 2.5 years of each other, so we kind of were in a mob. But we all handled it together, and even to this day, we're really close friends. At one point, I was in elementary school, and my brother had a bottle of wine hiding away from mom, and mom was really trying to get at it. I think I was in like fourth grade. Marty, my brother, ran into the bedroom and locked his door, and mom grabbed a hatchet and was trying to hatchet the door down. She lost interest and lost steam, and that and just growing up with it made me say, I'm never going to drink. I never, never will drink. And of course, that held until freshman year of high school. When I went to my first party, and I had my first party and my first kiss, and they happened the same night, okay? First beer, first party. And of course, I drank all the way through high school, all the way through college. And I think I knew I was an alcoholic from the start, but I was having too much fun. When I was a senior in college, I did a senior project majoring in journalism, thus the notebook. And for my senior project, I checked myself into a detox center. They're laughing. I don't get it. They told me to drink before I went in. It was an insurance thing. I went undercover, and I took notes. That's where I got my first AA big book. That's where I went to my first AA meeting. And I was absolutely astonished at the strength of the people there, how long they walked and what they had gone through to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. Fast forward, I moved to Gunnison, I got married, and inside my mind, I thought there was a level inside me that said, now I can really drink. Now I can really drink. And I did. I chose to not have kids, in part because I did not want them growing up the same way I grew up, in an alcoholic home, because I knew I was an alcoholic. I drank through my marriage. I was a poor communicator, probably still am, but I work on it. And my poor communication skills later came out in my ninth step with my ex-husband. I'm really glad for that ninth step. But backing up, I got divorced. My dog died. My job ended. We were bought by the competition and closed down that fast. And so I joke about my life in that stage. I was living a country western song, you know, dog, divorce, job ended, and of course all I did was drink. I did pray during this time. I would say the Lord's Prayer. I learned how to pray the rosary because I'd never learned how to do that, and one night I was saying the Lord's Prayer, and for the very first time out of the millions of times I had said the Lord's Prayer, the words, thy will be done, just hit me. So, as if, you know, so that's kind of when I, I moved on. I got a job. God saw fit to drop a job in my lap. It was a career advancement. I mean, all this drinking and all this debauchery. And I just kept climbing. I don't know what the deal was, but God dropped this job in my lap in a town I knew no one. I worked alone and I lived alone, and it was the ideal situation for someone who wanted to drink. But I saw, I went to work one day, and I'll tell you, the easiest thing I have ever done in my life is put sentences together. I could write a news story like that. But I got to my keyboard that morning, Monday morning, and I could not even think of any words. And I thought, uh-oh, this is what a wet brain is all about. Oh. You know, it terrified me, absolutely terrified me. So I ran home. And in the years of my mom's drinking, the words Alcoholics Anonymous had never been uttered. So I thought, well, maybe Alcoholics Anonymous works. I'm going to give them a call. I did, and a wonderful woman met me that night for my first meeting in a town 30 miles away. I didn't know a soul, and I remember that meeting as clear as if it was yesterday. There was laughter, there was fellowship, there was love. I mean, I bawled my eyes out, and they were laughing at the jokes, and they were having fun. And I think that's one of the things that I really latched on to. They can have fun. I'm going to get a drink. Thank you. Ah, thanks. Okay, about 6 weeks into AA, you know, when I thought I really had it licked, you know. I called mom and dad, got them both on the phone. See, I lived in Western Colorado and they lived in the Front Range, or Littleton. And I told them what I was doing, and my dad, the first thing he said was, "I'm so sorry I was such a crummy dad." And it just so surprised me. And of course, the easiest words out of my mouth at that point in time were, "It's okay, Dad. It's okay." It was easy to forgive. And of course, mom thought it was her fault. She was an alcoholic, so she must have given it to me. And I said, no, that's not the case. It's a disease. I firmly believe that it is genetic. It's a disease. And if I drink alcohol, it will in turn make me want more and crave more and crave more. So I continued going to meetings and continued to see hope and light. One of the greatest gifts of the AA program is working with newcomers and seeing the light come back in their eyes, seeing their families come back together, seeing their spouses reignite that love that they fell in love with to start with. And God working through me and working through people, it's just amazing to see what AA can do. It's just absolutely amazing. My dad died in 2003, and after that, I did a lot of work with my sponsor through some of the issues of growing up, and I actually got to see that onion peel flying off the onion. And my mom died in 2008, but before she died, she and I really bonded. It's like, you know, when you're talking with another alcoholic, you forge a bond. And I saw that with mom and I lived that with my mom and I. We, you know, we spent my seventh AA birthday together, and she now has my 9-year chip when I buried it with her when she died in 08. And I miss her, but she's still here. In my theme of it is a family disease, I took my sister to her first AA meeting. She absolutely loved it. and she hasn't been back, but I continue. She knows where to go. She knows where to go. And thank God AA is here for all of us, for people like my sister, for people like others in our family. And thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Mary. That was beautiful. And now I'd like to introduce David to you. David was in our group and unfortunately moved away, but we took the old hook and pulled him back. So please welcome David.
I need to keep the water close. I needed to get my little sobriety station ready. My name is David, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
Oh, no, this thing wobbles. My sobriety date is June 30th, 1999, and that is not my first sobriety date, but by the grace of God, the men and women that have shown me so much support and love and the fellowship, and by continuing to try and work an honest program, I certainly hope and pray that it'll be my last. And if you're new to AA, I would just say that even though relapse is part of my story, it does not have to be part of anybody's story. It's not recommended. It's not required. And I just feel grateful and blessed that I was able to make it back. So before I get too far into this, I did want to thank Bill D., who unfortunately wasn't able to make it here this evening, and Hallie Mae, who was able to make it, for inviting me back up here to Paradise to join you in this meeting, the traditional kickoff for the Crested Butte Mountain Conference. So it is quite the honor. So thank you. And I will try and work through the butterflies. And so I also wanted to take a moment to thank my sponsors, my mentors, various men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous, my spiritual advisors, certain authors and others that I have shamelessly stolen material from over the years for this talk, but I'm going to stick to the unwritten AA rule that having given them credit three times now, the material is mine. It's all mine. And so all those people know who they are. And let's see, what else was I going to say before I started? Oh, I wanted to apologize to you because I know me and I know my alcoholism and I have about 1,000 things spinning through my head right now and time to talk about only 10 of them. So please bear with me, and I didn't set my timer, so I hope somebody's doing it. That's good. So anyway, I was born and raised in a small town just south of the city of Portland. That is Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Texas. I'm sorry. I'm truly sorry. But I grew up in the household when I was very young with my mother and father, two older brothers, an older sister, and a younger brother. My younger brother and I are the only true my younger brother and I are the only native Oregonians. My father had moved the rest of the family to the Portland area from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And apparently, which I would find out years later, he moved from Minneapolis because he was trying to get away from the clutches of his alcoholic father. That little tidbit of information I wouldn't know for some time, but it would certainly loom large in my life as my alcoholism developed. But you know, I'm one of those people that believe that I was alcoholic the minute I left the womb. And I know that simply because I have, by the graces of this program, been able to understand now some gross thinking errors that I had at a very, very young age. I was more or less obsessed with my own wants, my own needs, and I always felt very uncomfortable in my own skin. I always had that churning in the gut. I always had that mind that would not shut off. And it was all about me. You know, I just didn't really get along with a lot of other people, even my own siblings. And, you know, and it was that those thinking errors, that obsession with self, that really was the key to that. I was the little kid running around, not playing well with my playmates. I was the kid that ran off the ball field with the ball and the bat because they weren't playing by my rules. I was the kid that I didn't want to be the seeker in hide and go seek. It's a boring position. Who wants to go hunt for these little rats? You know, so I would lean against the tree, close my eyes, count to 100, and then I'd just walk home. And I should have been concerned, I guess, how long they stayed hidden in the woods, but I wasn't. You know, a couple hours, a couple of days, who knows. But and my playmates wouldn't come around for a while after that, but they would always, sooner or later, return. You know, and so I'm developing certain thinking errors here that, you know, control and manipulation can sometimes takes patience. And bad behavior can garner just as much attention as good behavior. And so it was an amazing time, really. It should have been an amazing time. It should have been an absolutely wonderful, beautiful, magical time for me. My parents finally moved to a beautiful house in a beautiful neighborhood on a dead-end street, and the street dead-ended because it opened up into 600 acres of virgin forest land. I mean, it was gorgeous. There was a beautiful creek running down the middle of the entire length of the woods, as we would call it. And, you know, a lot of my memories are about being in those woods. But I just couldn't punch through the fact that I was obsessed with my own needs. I didn't get enough love. I didn't get enough attention. I never got enough respect. I never got enough food. I never got, you know, enough excitement in my life, enough fun in my life. I always wanted more. And it leads to, for me anyway, being unhappy most days. This thing's shaking again, isn't it? And so that's just the way that I lived my younger life. And, you know, my mother would constantly tell me, David, you need to learn how to get along with other people. And I was always saying, why? And I don't understand this, you know. I mean, people are in my life because they are there to entertain me. And I just didn't understand any other view. And, you know, I would later learn from Bill Wilson that any time that you force these wants and needs on others, that you demand that your baser instincts be met in disregard to everybody else's, it can only lead to a life of unhappiness. And then I remember Dale Carnegie once said that we do not derive happiness from who we are or what we have, but how we think. So I kind of got the idea that I was kind of screwed from a very young age. And, you know, perhaps things would have been better if instead of the usual bedtime story, my mother would have read to me from the Big Book or the 12 and 12. David, let me read you a bedtime story. Ooh, The Cat in the Hat? No, I was thinking 12 Traditions and 12 Steps and 12 Traditions by Bill Wilson. Say what? And but that wasn't going to be. I have to tell you, the magical time for me in my life at that time was any time that I could spend with my older sister. She just doted on my younger brother and I. She loved us and we loved her. She is, you know, just a very, very, she was just a very, very special person. She was one of those people that no matter who you were, she just made you feel special and she made you feel loved. And half the time when I was sent to my room for detention, I would take a hard left down the hallway and go into her room, and she would hold me, and I'd cry to her and explain to her all my anxieties about my wants and my needs aren't being met, and she would just take care of me and say everything's going to be okay. She always told me, things are going to be okay for you. You know, she's the one that took me into the woods, down the creek, and showed me where the waters pooled, and showed me how to catch crawdads and frogs and all sorts of strange little creatures, most of which we didn't identify, but it was just a very magical time. And so, as you can imagine, I was a product of 12 years of Catholic education, 8 years grade school, 4 years high school. I'm not here to bash Catholics like I used to. I realized that my alcoholic perceptions messed up my ability to process my thoughts properly. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, anything that I perceived in my life, whether it was from the Catholic Church or from the lessons learned from my mother or whatever, were just kind of all messed up. So, you know, I just had to keep that in mind. But I do remember, I'm about 9 years old. My sister's walking me to school one morning, and you know, I'm sure she would have preferred to walk to school with her friends, but as far as my mother was concerned, she wanted to ensure that I actually made it to school. And once again, my sister gave me the impression that it was always an honor to spend time with me, never a duty. But I am once again lost in my thoughts, doing something, and I just get the impression that she's not with me anymore. And I turn around, and she's fallen back a couple of blocks, and she's holding her head back. So I go running over to her, and she's developed this little nosebleed that doesn't seem to want to stop. And she's got some tissues, and it doesn't seem to be helping, so I walk her the rest of the way to school and get her to the nurse's station, and the nurse says everything will be fine, and you need to get to class, young man. And so I look for her after school, and I couldn't find her. It's not uncommon that she didn't have to walk me back home again, but when I did get home, the phone was ringing off the hook, and it's my mother, and she said, well, the nosebleeds continued throughout the day for your sister, and we're at the hospital, and everything's going to be okay, and we'll be home soon. But my sister would spend the next year in and out of the hospital, and at the end of that year, the leukemia would take her life. And, you know, I just remember being in the funeral home's limousine, and everybody in the family, of course, is in one car, and they're all crying except for me. You know, I'm not processing this emotional state of mind at all. I'm in complete denial. In fact, I'm kind of a little pissed at my family. Can't we just all pull together and wish this isn't so to change the reality? That's the way I thought, that if you just wished hard enough, you could change the reality. And that wasn't going to happen. And I really don't mention this part of my story very much anymore. Many years later, through counseling and by working grief and loss through the steps, but it is a critical component for me in my evolving alcoholism, and that as soon as that funeral was over, my older brother called the rest of us around him, and you know, he didn't have any experience with loss or grief anyway, so it's not really his fault. But he calls us around him, away from my mother, and says that you know, everybody needs to stop acting up, you know, and he's looking at me, and you need to, whatever you're feeling, you need to suck it in. We need to be strong for our mom and pull together. And so that's exactly what I did. And I began to build this huge fortress around my emotional state of mind. Nothing, again, would get in to hurt me. Nothing would get out that would expose my grief, my fear, my vulnerability. And may your God help you if you ever tried to breach that fortress. You know, and that's just the way that I started to live my life. And so anyway, I'm going to get a drink of water. So for a while, this new plan of my older brother's worked, and I didn't act up, at least for a while, but it didn't last for long, or it didn't last forever, I should say. But I just remember all of us walking around on eggshells. Nobody wants to upset our mom. And, you know, nobody wants to, we can't even mention our sister. You know, it's like she didn't exist. And it really kind of pissed me off. But the other critical component at this time in my life is I lost my spiritual connection with any God that I had acknowledged. Well-meaning people would say, you know, your sister's death, honey, is just God's will. And it really pissed me off. You know, I don't know who this God dude is, but nobody has the right to take my sister from me. And I would remain angry at God for many, many years to come. And so I should mention my father had left the home about a year before my sister was ill, and so he wasn't around anymore. I didn't really have time in this framework to talk about my father, though I could go on at length. But let's just say that his job as a traveling salesman meant that he wasn't around the home much when he was part of the home. And then when my parents were divorced, he wasn't around the home at all. He would show up around once or twice a year, usually around a holiday, and that's basically all the time we saw him. So anyway, I did go to high school, all boys Catholic high school, I think I mentioned. And you know, it wasn't a good time for me. The high school was 20, 25 miles from my hometown. My father was now out of the family. My mother never learned how to drive. And so even though we caught rides to the priest that taught at the high school from my local town, we had to be on that 3:45, 4 o'clock bus, or we weren't getting home. And so I did not do any extracurricular activities, no high school sports. I didn't participate in dances or proms. And before any of you think too hard on that one line, the all-boys Catholic high school would hook up with the all-girls Catholic high school. And so that's how they made that arrangement. But I was left out. And I vowed in my teenage years that whenever I was in control of my life, I would never, ever again miss out on anything. And that would drive me. And this alcoholism would be fueled by these selfish, self-centered motives once again. And so the first time I drank was at my senior graduation. There was a party after high school graduation. A couple of my friends now had cars, and so they came and got me, and they took me to a party. I wish I could tell you what happened at that party, but I can't. I drank to blackout. So, where was I? I drank to blackout. What I do remember is my friends hauling me out the door back to the car, and one of the girls that threw the party was on the porch, and she said, "Boy, you know, I don't know who that guy is, but we need to invite him back to all our parties." And to this day, I can't tell you what I did or what happened. I just convinced myself I was making up for lost time. My friends, of course, are in panic mode because they have to take me back home. So we stop off at a Denny's, and apparently I spent an hour heaving my guts out in the bathroom. And I just remember, I do remember leaning over the urinal and feeling so happy and so joyous. And I had such a release from all I had been holding on to. You know, that booze went right through that fortress I built, and it touched me deeply inside. And I loved that feeling. And it was like my sister was telling me again, everything is going to be okay. But I didn't drink again for a while after that, and I was busy summer school. There was a lot of money in the family, of course, after the divorce, so I worked hard to save up enough money. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I attended a commuter's college in downtown Portland, and I took a couple of criminal justice courses just as part of my history major, and I loved it. I arranged a couple of ride-alongs with the Portland Police Bureau, and I was hooked. Here was a job that could provide me with an extreme amount of excitement. I could give back to the community. I just tell people that. But, man, here's something that can hold my interest. I want to be bored. I would be excited all the time. Every ride along I went on, the landscape changed daily, by the hour, by the minute. It was thrilling. And so I pursued that. And I really need to move along here. But anyway, I was hired as a police officer for my small hometown in 79. I transferred to the city of Portland in 84. And I just, it was everything I wanted. I just loved the job. It would come to define me. You know, I was a guy that didn't like my days off. I didn't like taking forced vacation days because it would take me from the job, you know? And after you talk to a few hundred victims, you also decide at some point that you're never going to be a victim. And so I'm on duty 24/7. And the only way that I seem to can relax is to take a few drinks. And so that's where my drinking really started taking off. I guess I need to mention, what's my time like?
8:30.
Oh, till 8:30?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was married. And, you know, out of that relationship, I have two beautiful, loving, caring daughters. And today, because of this program, I have a relationship with them. But I accept today also the full responsibility and accountability for the demise of that relationship. You know, I was sick of my disease, and even though she was an adult child of an alcoholic who married an alcoholic, I can't diagnose her that way because that's not what we do with people. But I do know she, if she needed a program, she wasn't working one. And nor was I. And so just a very sick relationship. It was 9 years old. The marriage lasted 9 years. And like I said, I accept responsibility. I never intended not to come home all those nights, you know, but that's where my disease took me. It was never my motive or my intent to do that to her, to do that to anybody. But once again, I stayed true to my promise of never, ever missing out on anything in my life. And I selfishly went to the party that led to the party that led to the party. I would wake up in places I didn't even know how I got there. It was quite the nightmare, actually. And then, you know, years later, when I made my amends to my former spouse, she would ask me that. Was it about the women? No. It was just about my selfish, self-centered needs and where this disease took me. And it was about the party. It was never about the women. It was about never being left out of anything. And so after the divorce, the drinking continued. And of course, this would draw the attention of my supervisors on the job eventually. And in 1993, I was sent to drug and alcohol counseling. The drug and alcohol counselor, I'm sure, was very competent, but I wasn't exactly forthcoming with what my issues were. And I'm sure he could have helped me a lot if I had been so. But he thought after I was done with my shtick that maybe I wasn't an alcoholic, and that diagnosis would last for 4 years until 97 when they sent me to residential treatment. And so it was recommended by my union rep that you need to get into AA, and you need at least to know enough about AA so that you can talk about it intelligently if you're called into the chief's office. And so... being a good trooper, I followed my assignment, and I hated it. I didn't like your little sayings. I didn't like your reliance on God. I didn't like your issues with spiritual matters. And, you know, well, let's put it this way. My favorite line in the big book at that time was, "We are a people who normally would not mix." Yeah, thank. So I just said at one point, to hell with you people. I'll just sponsor myself. I'll read the big book. You know, I'm educated. I can read that big book, though it made no sense to me, you know, without a sponsor to guide me through it. And then I'll do the steps with a little bit of editing. I'll do half of step one, which means I'm thinking maybe I am an alcoholic, but I'm not convinced my life is unmanageable. I didn't realize there's no conjunction between those phrases. You know, to me, I know that by admitting I'm an alcoholic, that perhaps it's a better phrase for me that my mind is unmanageable. If I'm living in selfish, self-centered fear, delusional thinking, or in self-pity, I'm not managing my life properly. I didn't get that part, though. But I would do half of step one, and then I would remove every single step that had anything to do with God because I didn't like God, and I'm pretty sure, based on where this disease took me, God probably didn't much care for me either. And so two and three steps, those are out. I know what you people mean when you say a power greater than yourself. Step four is followed up immediately by step five. Step five involves God, so if I'm not doing five, there's no point in doing four. Six and seven, God out. Eight and nine, I'm not doing on principle. My drinking never harmed anybody. My drinking never harmed anybody. When people start making amends to me, then I'll consider some reciprocity. Of course, Bill Wilson, as I would learn later, calls out purposeful forgetting. And what I know now, any time that we put somebody's emotional security at risk, we harm them. And I harmed a lot of people. But 10 I could do. Okay, try and be a better person. I can do 10. 11, God, it's out. 12, spiritual awakening, must be God, that's out. So I'm ready. I got my 1.5-step program. And so when I got that treatment the second time, I'm really kind of lost, but I'm not really getting the AA thing. And so it would take a third trip to treatment. But I'm still not really getting it. You know, I did the first three steps with my sponsor, and he told me, you know, a lot of good information. And I wanted this. I wanted this. I needed this. I was in the hopeless state of mind now. You know, I was at the jumping off place. I couldn't see life with booze, but I couldn't see life without it. But I couldn't get to that step four. You know, I had all this guilt and shame, and I didn't know how to process it. I used my home group as my higher power to begin with, and it was sufficient to make a start, but I needed to find a God of my understanding that would get me the rest of the way. And boy, this time went fast. I have found that God of my understanding. You know, I sat down with a group of alcoholic men and a spiritual advisor, and I tried to look through my life and look for good examples of faith, and I didn't have to look much further than my own mother. And all the heartache and the tragedy that she endured, and she's not an alcoholic, she never once lost her faith. So I revisited a lot of that, and when I found that the principles of my new rediscovered faith meshed seamlessly with the principles of this program, I was certainly on my way. And, you know, nothing would ever be the same again for me. Bill Wilson talks to me, and I talk about this because to me it is my greatest gift. Bill Wilson talks about putting our thought life on a different basis, of putting it on a higher plane, of having God direct our thinking, because my thinking is so corrupted. I need someone to direct me. And to me, that is God. But it is in the spiritualization of the consciousness today that is my greatest gift. I often say in meetings, I have an irreparable debt to the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous who have reintroduced me to the God of my understanding, and I truly believe that today. You know, Emmett Fox talks anecdotally about a certain man who's tending his garden, and he's being assisted by his little daughter who's watering another part of the garden with a rubber hose. And suddenly, the little girl cries out, "Daddy, Daddy, the water has stopped running." And the man looks over there and sizes up the situation and says quietly, "Honey, take your foot off the hose." The analogy, of course, is Emmett says that one of the greatest mistakes we make is we put the whole weight of our experience, and I might add, that whole crushing burden of our preoccupation with self on the pipeline of life, and then we wonder why God's given spiritual waters of growth and understanding and healing are shut off. This disease shut those waters off in me. You know, at the end, I was just withering away inside and dying. But the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have showed me a way to remove my foot from the hose. And I am eternally grateful to all of you for that. Or as another book puts it, and this is important for me today, "And God shall guide thee continually, and he shall nourish your soul in drought, and thou shalt be like a watered garden, and thou shalt be like a spring of water, whose waters fail not." And so if you're new to AA, I just would end With this, something from the big book. Well, I don't need this. From Dr. Silkworth, paraphrased. It is recommended that you read this book through and through. And though you, perhaps like me, originally came here to scoff, it is hoped that you will remain to pray. I owe you all my life, so thank you. Thank you so very much.